Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. This is the Roguecast for the week of Wednesday, April 8th, brought to you by Thund Blood Rack, which is actually the name of a barbarian miniature we just got in, which is the best name ever.
It is.
It's really good.
You can tell just from his name, he is not to be trifled with.
No.
He will blood rack you.
Yeah, Thund Blood Rack will blood rack you.
He'll blood rack you hard.
So we'll start off, as always, with our rundown of stuff. This is a big weekend for us. Daredevil is on Friday.
It's true.
It's on Netflix. Just a last reminder. We are doing a marathon to celebrate Nick's birthday eve.
Yes.
Then to celebrate Nick's birthday, tabletop day at the store.
Right.
The
11th. That was nice of Fletcher Day to coincide that with Nick's birthday.
It really was.
We talked it over.
Tabletop day is April 11th. This Saturday should be a really fun time. We've got a big crowd coming in. And don't forget that if you're here around 6, you can defeat me and possibly Dave in Geek Out Trivia.
I'm going to try to be there. And we will decimate all comers.
Yep, we're taking on all comers.
I dare you to show up.
That's right.
We won't even do it.
What happens if somebody beats you guys?
They get the store.
They get to kick us in the nuts.
they get the prize. They get the boasting of having beaten the two big geeks out of Geek Out.
You know, I was reminded, Randy. We wouldn't have time to do it for at this point, but. Somebody reminded me when we did comic book trivia some years ago that the trophy that we gave out was like a karate trophy.
That's right.
Showed some dude getting kicked in the face.
That is correct.
Oh, I was going to ask something that I don't actually recall about our tabletop day.
Yeah.
Is what time do the demos start?
Starts at noon and runs till about 6.
Okay.
And then, like I say, at 6 we'll be doing the Geek Out. And we'll also have the table set up. If anyone wants to stick around and play games, we have a big game library. People are welcome to stick around and play.
Yep. I feel like, in general, it'll be a good day to throw out any kind of game questions you got.
Yep.
You know, see a lot of cool games in action.
And there'll be cool little demo cards for various games. And people playing the demos will get prizes. It's a fun day.
Yeah.
Then next week on Monday is Ladies Night at Starco Coffee. Next week on Tuesday is Reading with Rogues doing Birthright from Image.
We're doing those at
Mesa Rosa.
Mesa Rosa.
And then also at Mesa Rosa the following Monday, Gaming with Rogues, doing Settlers of Catan.
The classic.
Yeah, classic. And then, of course, just mention our Friday Night Magic started up again this week. And our staffer, John, told me that it went really well.
Yep.
We had a good group of people, a lot of kids, a lot of families, a lot of sort of casual Magic players.
Yeah, I believe it was precisely kind of what we wanted it to be.
Yeah, and then the people were talking about coming back. And so if you have any interest in playing Magic on Fridays, it sounds like it's a good group.
Yes.
So we recommend that. And also, looming about a month from now is Free Comic Book Day.
Looming indeed.
Yes. I'm very excited, especially for this year's Avengers offering that's going to have that new Avengers
theme.
There's
a lot of great
books. I'm excited and terrified.
And the Secret Wars teaser, right?
Yeah. I want to see what that is.
So, all right, moving on to news. There's a fair bit of news this week. First of all, there's three sort of campaign crowdfunding things I want to mention that I have backed and that I thought people might be interested in seeing. First off, there's a new game from Keith Baker, who did Eberron and Gloom, and he has a new card-based RPG called Phoenix Dawn Command. This is on Kickstarter.
Yeah. Like any Kickstarter, you can go and watch the cool video for it, where he talks you through it.
And it's basically sort of we think it's maybe a Fiasco-esque storytelling RPG kind of thing.
Yeah, it may have a campaign element, I don't know that, but it seems like it might be ideally suited for sort of those one-night adventures and stuff.
Well, the notion of it is that basically there's skin changers in the forest and all, it's like a dark, gloomy world, and your heroes are phoenixes, who basically
they can
resurrect. And each time they resurrect, they get closer to final death, but they also get more powerful. So dying is actually part of the strategy of the game.
Right, but apparently you sort of have to strategically die.
Yeah, you have to know when it was the time to sacrifice yourself.
Right.
Yes. And it uses cards as your strength and your spirit and all that are cards that you have in your hand that you use to do things.
And is there a cooperative element that's key to it,
Yeah, it sounds like there's a team-based element. It sounds like a lot of fun. I booked it. There is not...
Knowing that he did one of the all-time great settings for D&D and has done one of the great card games in Gloom, this seems to kind of combine his two passions.
I'm very much looking forward to it. There is not, at this moment, a retailer level. I don't know if eventually it'll go to distribution, but for right now, that is the way to get it. There is a retailer level, however, for Steve Jackson's Car Wars Arenas, which is a new Car Wars game they're doing. And we have backed that. So there's a new game that's going to come out in December. I don't know that much about it. I just know it's a new Car Wars game.
I have not seen this one. That, right? Now they've had the new box set,
the classics.
That recreates the. Is it a precise recreation of the original one?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because I know the packaging and stuff is.
Yep.
So this presumably will be something newish.
Yeah, this will be a new take on Car Wars for the modern era.
Yep.
So that'll be fun. And then finally, our good friend Chris Schweitzer, who has been here for a few of our all ages events.
Yep. One of my favorite artists we have out,
and he's great.
He's like a wizard who can draw all.
He really is. And he has a new sketchbook. You can get either a PDF or the actual book. I think there's like 1 or 2 days left to get in on this. But if you go to Chris Schweitzer's website. And I'll put a link in our notes, show notes this week. He's got a book called 555 Characters. That will be 555 characters. And if you've seen his character sketches, you know this is going to be a pretty astounding book.
Yeah. Well, if I'm not mistaken, some of these are ones, because I was skimming through it, and I have him friended on Facebook.
Yeah.
So periodically I'll see these things he does that are sort of like model sheets.
Yeah.
And he'll like go and like pluck characters from history. Yeah. Like, you know, sort of unsung character. He obviously reads a ton of history for the comics he does.
Yeah.
And he'll find these interesting unsung heroes, you know, dating back, you know, from you know, like 100 years or like 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he does these awesome, like, you know, at least fairly historically researched renditions of them with some little notes and stuff off to the side. They're super cool model sheets.
Yeah.
And I don't know what all else is going in there.
Yeah.
I
assume fan commissions, some of his court, you know, his portraits for stuff like Sherlock and that kind of stuff, I bet. He does a lot of characters, like pop culture stuff too. So it's really, I think it's going to be.
I wonder if like I got a little commission of him for my Shakespeare reading group of Macbeth.
Yeah.
Like about a year ago.
That might wind up in there.
Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. So that's definitely worth looking at. Last week we took a listener question about the X-Men universe and whether or not it was spinning off into its own thing.
Right.
They have pretty much firmly denied that now.
Yeah, it's true.
They have said, no, the X-Men are still going to be part of. It's going to be – there's X-Men miniseries and Secret Wars, and spinning out of Secret Wars, there will be X-Men series. It's set in the Marvel Universe.
Oh, interesting. I have not seen the refutations. Yeah.
So X-Men are going to be very much a part of the Marvel Universe. That is that speculation is sort of fan conspiracy theory and not much more. Green Lantern is getting a crossover with Star Trek.
Right. This is, you know, we were just talking about we'd like to see some more crossovers.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like Marvel and DC are playing nice right now.
No.
But between
companies. But IDW is.
Yeah. This seems like a pretty natural one to, you know, basically DC space opera character and the, you know, one of the classic sci-fi comics. I guess just from the art I saw, it looks like it is the Abrams-verse
version. Yeah, it is.
But that makes sense. That's what they've been doing in the comics, is adapting old classic Trek episodes sort of through the lens of the updated characters.
Right.
I don't know if we know a plot or anything.
Not really. I don't think – but it wouldn't surprise me to see some of the Green Lantern core and see some of the different characters.
Yeah, what I was wondering – what I want to know is Kirk going to get over it? He seems very Hal Jordan.
Oh, I could totally see that. Actually, what would be great is if all of them got rings.
And a drunk Scotty just flies into a wall.
Well, they could do the spectrum. They could all have different rings.
Yeah, that's true.
Who's going to get stuck with a pink ring?
Oh, so sexist.
The yellow ring.
The Guardians, the Guardians of the Universe.
Yeah.
I was thinking... they need to meet with the Organians, godlike aliens who basically stopped the Klingons and the humans from or the Federation from having a war.
It wouldn't shock me that is going to be.
I can see that as an interesting point of contention. Basically, the two power players.
Yeah.
It seems like a fun idea.
What about the super powerful aliens from the arena?
The arena?
Isn't that the one where they send Kirk to fight?
I don't know. There's always super powerful aliens.
Yeah.
Star Trek originated the whole super powerful aliens who try and battle good versus evil or like to experiment on humans.
Maybe they'll be having a sort of Grandmaster-esque fight with the Guardians.
I can see it. Yeah. What I want out of this is I want to see a Green Lantern single-handedly taking on like a Klingon ship or a Romulan ship or a fleet of them or something.
That'd be cool.
But I don't want to see them. The bad guys get punked. I want to see the Romulans use cool cloaking technology and have like anti-Green Lantern weaponry and stuff. That'd be cool.
That'd be cool. It sounds like fun. Not coming out till later this year, I believe.
Do we know who the creative team is?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. Hopefully it's not somebody who sucks.
speaking of movie stuff, we weren't But
there's going to be a television. Television is like baby movies.
Star Trek's a movie now. Star Trek's all true. Movies now.
There you go. Segue.
There is a
real smooth.
There's a new cut of Days of Future Past. X-Men Days of Future Past coming out. That is going to be 11 minutes longer and is going to put all the Rogue scenes back in.
Right. I guess there was sort of a subplot with.
Yeah, there was a whole little story with her, and they just cut it out for time.
You know, I know they used Kitty in the movie.
Yeah.
But since Rogue in the movies was kind of the Kitty analog, you know, she was the one who bonded with Wolverine. She was the new one to the team and all that stuff.
Yep.
Actually, I guess Wolverine was new to the team. Anyway.
Yeah.
It would sort of, it makes sense that in Days of Future Past, where Kitty played a prominent role, to have a Rogue arc in there.
Yeah.
So, Randy, I know you already bought this.
Also, Bryan Singer has said that he's going to put some other tweaks in there. Like, he's going to sort of... It's going to be essentially a different cut of the movie.
Oh, interesting.
I already bought Days of Future Past. Nick, did you already buy Days?
Yeah, I already bought it.
I don't think I'll buy it again, but I'll probably rent it.
Well, I held off, so this is definitely going to be my purchase copy.
Yeah.
I'll just punch Dave and take his.
Good idea. I'll punch you and take Dave's.
Aw.
Smooth. As smooth as your segue, sir. but anyway, yeah. Well, in some way, shape, or form, we'll all see it.
Yeah.
Did y'all like... I generally like Anna Paquin as Rogue.
I do, too.
She's not the comic book Rogue.
Yeah.
But I like her.
The thing is, I really like the comic book version of Rogue, and I'm kind of bummed that we don't get a movie version of that character.
You need the big hair?
But I liked the character they did. I mean, they basically turned her into Kitty Pryde.
What if they CG'd some big 80s hair on her?
All right, sure. Like George Lucas style?
I didn't like what they did with her story arc in the third one, but you know.
The third one doesn't count at all for anything.
That's, I mean, that was a fistful of errors.
Yep.
You can't blame her on that. But you liked her okay in the role?
Yeah,
not
she was
like,
fine.
You know, separate from that.
Yeah, I thought she was fine.
So anyway, we'll all be curious to see what they do.
Also, moving on, no segue because there's really no way to segue here. Sesame Street has put up a new video.
Yeah,
the game of chairs.
I have not seen it.
It is a Game of Thrones sequence. What cracks me up about this is it is both completely safe for kids and makes so many nods to Game of Thrones that it's absolutely aimed at people who are watching Game of Thrones.
Wow. Do they, I'm trying to think. You
so
know,
sort
I know
of
that
Pixar effect.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they make a reference to Joffrey that is basically a spoiler for what has happened in the show.
Nice.
They make a Ned Stark, they make puppets for Joffrey and Ned and Cersei and Daenerys and Tyrion. They're all puppets of them.
Uh-huh.
And they're playing awesome. A game of musical chairs.
So it's actually them? It's not like a little Muppety kind of creature version?
It's a Muppety version of them, but it looks like them.
Okay.
It was clearly a custom version. Like, it's custom puppets.
And this is actual Jim
This
Detention
is actual
Studios
Sesame Street. It's actually on Sesame Street. They're playing a game of musical chairs to determine who will win the throne.
Game of
Thrones,
sort of, yeah.
And Grover is the one who is sort of emceeing the whole thing while Ned sort of tells him what to do. And Grover is hapless at it and doesn't know when to stop the music and is sort of flailing everywhere. And it's very funny. But they make all these references, and I'm like, no kid gets this, and no kid should.
So here's my question. I can't remember, you know, other than maybe the occasional mildly risque joke in, like, the movies – have the Muppets kind of done this kind of stuff before? They must have parodied some movies that are.
They
before.
Did a Law and Order SVU parody.
Wow.
Yep.
I remember that one.
Yeah. They have definitely. There are some hipsters up at this Sesame Street, and they do some stuff that is very much aimed for the parents.
I'll have to watch this later. Then.
It was fun. It's a lot of fun.
But this is sort of in conjunction because doesn't Game of Thrones start?
Game of Thrones starts
Sunday?
On Sunday. Yep.
Which I'm excited for.
Me too.
I like to think that it's actually like HBO paid them off to do this. It's what do they call it? Native advertising.
Yes, native advertising.
Yeah.
finally, there is a new trailer for the next DC direct-to-video animation.
Notable because Bruce Timm is actively involved in producing.
Yeah, Bruce Timm is. I think wrote it.
Really? Oh, yeah?
I think he wrote and directed.
All right.
So this is going to be the closest thing to the JLU universe and that kind of, I mean, that feel.
You know, but we know that totally it's going to be different. So
but
it's
called JLA Gods and Monsters.
Right.
And it is a standalone news story. It's an Elseworlds where the Superman is sort of the son of Zod, I think.
I don't know.
And Wonder Woman is sort of a warrior type and Batman's a vampire and the Justice League.
I don't know if I quite caught that.
Yeah. And the Justice League is sort of this, they're sort of at odds with the world and someone is trying to frame them for murder or something.
Right. And it is clearly a dark, you know, paranoid version of sort of a world paranoid about the Justice League.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps rightly so.
Yeah.
I mean, are they even good guys in this?
Or? I think they're supposed to be the get things done kind of good guys.
Right, justify like the authority.
The authority. But vampires. I saw the voice casting. I think CCH Pounder is doing Amanda Waller again. I think it's Kevin Conroy Superman, or maybe it's the Justice League Unlimited voice. But the voice casting looks good. The animation looks great. I'm interested. I would not have thought I was, but I'm interested in seeing what they do here.
The trailer just looks so dark.
It is dark. The thing is, weirdly, I'm not a fan of dark in general, but I like it as sort of one-off occasionally. Like, that's why I like Injustice.
Right.
And I think this is in the same vein as that.
But some of the animations lately have been a little bit dark for my taste.
And, yeah.
I mean, even Flashpoint they made really dark.
Yeah.
Flashpoint and like the Arkham one. With the Suicide Arkham Squad. One
especially.
I like the Suicide Squad one.
I thought it was okay. But
yeah. Yeah. None of these have risen above okay for me.
Right.
I don't have really any interest in this one. Even with Tim. If somebody told me it was good, I'd probably watch it. But yeah. Right now I'm like, eh.
I'm curious to see this
one. I think the best animation they've done in forever is the Red Hood one.
Yeah, the Red Hood was one of the better ones.
I've watched that multiple times.
Well, and the shorts that came on the Superman Shazam one, the Green Arrow and the Spectre shorts, those are probably the best ones they've done. All right, that closes out our news for the week. We'll be back in just a few seconds with our listener question for the week. All right, it's time for our listener question of the week. And as always, if you send us a question, you can either post it on our Facebook, where we try to do a questions post every week, or you can send us an email at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. If you are local to us and you want to come by, we will give you a prize pack of comics for asking a question and getting it read on the air. This week's come to us from one of our regulars, Jerry Guerra.
Hi, Jerry.
And he posted on our Facebook, which all you need to do is go to our Facebook on Tuesday. We'll post a questions post, and you just post it in the comments there. And Jerry says, my question is, am I the only one that's had it with Marvel's relaunching and renumbering? And also, can they please drop the red Marvel now at the bottom of the covers? We get it already. Thoughts, guys? And I think we're all sort of we're not with you on this, Jerry.
Well, I get the idea. I think because I've worked at a comic shop for like 15 years now, I've gotten used to reboots.
Yeah.
And the thing I like about Marvel's thing is that it is generally in number only.
Yeah,
they've kept their universe all these years. Hopefully, that won't change with Secret Wars.
I don't think they're rebooting with Secret Wars.
They're not. And so essentially, what they do though is about every year or two, they seem to roughly relaunch as a way to draw new readership.
Yeah.
Now, collection wise, it kind of drives me nuts a little bit. Endless
Endless Volume 1s.
Yeah, or, you know, Avengers will become Avengers now, or all new Avengers.
Yeah.
So I definitely get the frustration. But overall, because it's mostly just a marketing gimmick, and I'm still getting the characters in the same characters I always was, it doesn't bother me too much.
It doesn't bother me because I see the difference. Avengers 637 is not going to sell as much as Avengers number 1.
No.
And the fact of the matter is, when you bring in a new creative team and they're doing a new take, a new number one makes sense because it's saying, hey, look, the book you've been reading, that book is gone. Here's the new book.
I think people would come in and be like, oh, it's issue 637. Do I need to read this 637?
Yeah, people want to
six before?
Increasingly, people want to start at the beginning. Old school guys like us, we used to jump in at whatever issue number was on the shelves.
Right. It was just kind of the thing to do.
That's not the way it is anymore.
You know what I think the deal is? Because I think TV has kind of changed that attitude.
Yeah.
It used to be if you wanted to get in on a TV show, like I'm talking 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s,
sure.
And 80s even, you did not have options for DVD sets. You did not have Netflix. You didn't have all the digital options there are now, or TiVo or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
You came in on what you came in on, and you rolled with it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
But because people are used to it now, it's like, oh, I want to get into Dexter. Well, you can find Dexter, and you can watch it from
start with episode one.
Yeah. And so I think there is just sort of more. That's the expectation.
Yeah.
And the venerable numbers, you know, those old something that numbers in the 600s, which used to be a kind of a cool mark of like, wow, this book must have some
legs. Yeah, it's been going around for a long time.
Is now kind of a detriment.
It's a barrier. It is absolutely a barrier. And I think that now they pull it out.
Manga somewhat influenced that too, yeah. Because they would have these long series volumes, but you could get in on volume one, and yeah. It was obviously volume one.
Well, now they pull out, the thing that does drive me crazy is when they pull out the numbers for anniversaries. Like, they're about to do Uncanny X-Men number 600. And I'm like,
right.
Guys, it hasn't been 600 for a long time.
Yeah, like, that's the cheap thing.
I don't like that.
Marvel does that more than any of them, I think. I mean, DC has done a couple.
But it's Marvel.
Like, for Detective Comics and things like that. But it's mainly Marvel.
So they'll have, like, issue 17, 18, 19, 20, and then suddenly 21 would have been, like, issue 600. They'll suddenly turn it into 600 again or something.
What I would like is one of two things for them, just to make it clearer. The one that I'd really like is when a book has a different creative team, like, say, Mark Waid's Daredevil. I would love it if that book was called Mark Waid and Chris Samnee's Daredevil, and then put the issue numbers on, and it's how long they've been on the book.
Right.
Like, whenever, you know.
I guess because creative teams shake up so often, they kind of can't necessarily anticipate or rely.
And also because they don't want to have to. They don't want to promote the creators to that extent. They want to promote the characters.
That's always been the tricky middle line. I mean, they do promote them more than they used to.
They do, but it's. They don't want to.
Right. They want the creators to somewhat feel like we could replace you anytime. Yeah. Anybody can write back.
And also, I mean, it's just not many creators stay on a book for that long.
Yeah. Although nowadays, like, there is more of a trend, you know, like Hickman's been on Avengers for a while now, Waid's been on Daredevil for a while, Bendis has been on everything he's been on for a while now.
Yeah. I think, though, what I would like them to do, and I think they could see this happening, is to do seasons just like TV.
Yeah.
Just call it Daredevil Season 1 or whatever you're going to do, and then have the issue numbers, and renumber it each year, or renumber it when there's a big change.
Right.
I'm actually okay with the renumbering and relaunching. I think that in general it gives people a good reason to jump onto a book they might not have been reading already.
You know, Jerry mentioned the banners thing.
Yeah.
And like when New 52 relaunched and they had those New 52 on a lot of the books.
Yeah.
I think that branding was for several years was kind of important.
Yeah.
Because one of the things New 52 did pretty successfully was tell a new generation, this is your DC.
Yeah.
This ain't your daddy's DC.
Yeah.
And so. That branding was a pretty strong one.
Yeah.
I don't know if the Marvel Now ones are that important, but I do kind of appreciate that it does chop up a big chunk off the art each month just as far as what looks good on the book. You're going to always have some... They're going to have to know there's going to be a swath of red.
The other notable thing about the Marvel Now, the red, from Marvel's point of view, is if you're a Marvel guy and you want to know what Marvel books came out that week, it's easy to spot them.
Yeah.
It's a marketing thing, and it makes a certain amount of sense. It's a
brand. And you know, Jerry, I think you're a guy who, you kind of know what you're after. You know, you know the industry at this point. So, to you, you're like, I don't need this fluff.
Right.
But I guess the audiences that are the new guys walking in the door, it seems like it works pretty well for them.
Yeah, a lot of the thing is that a lot of people don't have this sort of knowledge of comics that all of us... I think all us old school guys, we'd be like, yeah, but keep the issue numbers going and just give us cover art. We know what we're looking for.
We want to make
sure comics are approachable to as many people as possible. And I think... easy access, easily being able to easily spot the covers you're looking for, and number ones for whenever you're ready to jump on. That makes it good for new people,
right? So yeah, I guess as retailers, we sort of see an angle that other people don't, which is we see what draws our customers' attention.
Yeah, yeah,
and what succeeds with them, and for better or worse, the Marvel's approach generally seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, it does seem to be that is the way the market has gone.
Yep.
All right. Thank you for the question, Jerry, and we will get you a prize pack very soon in your file.
Yep.
Y'all send us questions, and we'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for this week. All right, we are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, April 8th, and it is a great week for comics.
It is. Yep.
There's a ton of stuff to talk about.
I hadn't looked at it very closely, and there was several books that sort of surprised me that came out, and I was like, oh, this is hitting this week. Or, oh, right, there's another Darth Vader this week.
Yeah, it's a bunch of new ones and some of my favorites. And so we're going to jump right in. And Dave, tell us about Rebels number one, which is not a Star Wars book.
Despite the fact
that it's from the guy who wrote Star Wars and Dark Horse.
That's true. When I saw that on the list, it did not connect with me that this is what the book was, but this is a book I've actually been looking forward to. Brian Wood, who's sort of no stranger to historical fiction, or historical-based fiction in comics, I guess, like the, what was his?
Northlanders,
yeah, his Viking comic. Before the Vikings TV show came out in the last few years, right. He was kind of doing the more realistic, you know, and more historically accurate take on Vikings. No pointy hats.
Right, right.
And Rebels is his spin on the American Revolution.
Yep.
I saw from the his closing notes that he's actually going to range around a little bit, like it sounds like he did on Northlanders, where you would see different segments of it. He even talked about, like, showing what, you know, sort of what's going on with Native Americans during this, so it's not just sort of the obvious history book stuff. And also because it's very very much surrounding the notion of a militia forming to oppose British tyranny.
Yeah.
I am sure that there will be some reflection on what that means. You know, I'm sure it's going to have some reflection on current events.
Right.
Probably questions about right to bear arms. What does a well-regulated militia mean?
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Isn't this one called something like a well-regulated militia? Or they make reference to that somewhere?
Maybe that's the title of the first issue.
I think it is.
I think it's on the front, but I think it's maybe the issue title.
I think that's, the title of the story, yeah.
Anyway, it's got a really cool cover that shows several sort of several rebels and some redcoats marching through the forest. Very graphically interesting. And you know, Wood works with a lot of strong artists. I don't know who Andrea Muti is.
I don't know either, but it's good art.
Yeah, it's really strong artwork, kind of from a realistic school. It made me think a little bit of sort of British styles of art.
Yeah.
It follows, just in the first issue, it actually begins some years before the big events of the American Revolution. And it follows a kid with a very sort of taciturn dad who I think they live in Vermont, is it? Or at least that's
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, yeah. And I know some of the action later takes place in Vermont.
They make reference to it being post-Tea Party, don't they?
Yes.
The Tea Party and the...
Actually, or is that only when it jumps forward in time?
Oh, maybe so.
Yeah, this first one is in 1768. So
oh, okay, so it's before that. Okay.
But there's already sort of opposition at that point, including some armed opposition. And then it forwards a little ways, and you have sort of a central characters of, like, basically two boyhood friends, and also a girl who owns whose father owns a farm nearby.
Right, yeah.
Who ends up playing a fairly major role in it.
Yeah.
It weaves in and around what I believe are all historical incidents, including there's a confrontation at a courthouse that occurs in this. Now, I'm not 100% sure if this one was accurate or, I mean, you know, was a real event or not.
I'm not sure either.
I think that one might be based more on the kind of skirmishes and flare-ups that they had just prior to full-blown revolution.
But that's what I like, is that it feels of the piece. Even if they're adding details, it feels true to the period.
Right. I also like the characters. You know, this is a kid who grew up with kind of a stern father who mm-hmm. didn't speak much, but he ends up sort of, it seems like he's got a certain revolutionary gift for rhetoric.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like for kind of rallying people, and so that's going to be, he's going to be sort of on the front line, and Knowing Brian Wood, I imagine he's probably going to also show that they are just people, that they are not, you know, it's he didn't want to write, I think he mentioned specifically, he didn't want to write about, like, legends.
Yeah.
He wants to write about sort of the normal people caught up in it.
Right.
And so I imagine mistakes will be made. You will probably get to see both the strengths and weaknesses of the, you know, these early American freedom fighters.
Yeah.
And just skimming through the, what he's describing, what we're going to get in it. He said on the last page, he says, Rebels tells the story of the Revolutionary War from that first spark of rebellion up to and including Bunker Hill and Dorchester Heights. We'll skip around and tell one-off tales that round out the era, including stories about Native Americans, about urban living at the time, the war through the eyes of a redcoat, and a rather heartbreaking retelling of the Molly Pitcher folktale.
Huh,
I don't know what that is, but I like the breadth of it. I just a few months ago read the book 1776, this big Pulitzer Prize winning look at the first year of the war from sort of the military history side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been on my mind, and I've been looking forward to it from since that came out, and it's a good first issue.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, AMC is about to put their show Turn back on for season 2, and that's the Revolutionary War Spies, and that show is kind of boring.
Yeah.
I did not find that of Rebels. I thought Rebels was a good first issue.
There's a shooting in it.
There's shooting in it.
In fact, weirdly, that opening scene, I hate to even bring it up, but it reminded me a little of the Mel Gibson Patriot.
Movie,
because it was a father and a son.
Yeah, sure.
Does anybody run across a battlefield holding a flag?
And stab.
And stab
a scummy Britishman with it.
Hey, spoilers for the Patriot.
Britishman. Man, that movie.
Yeah, that movie.
This is not like that in any other way.
Nope.
Only in that vague first open. And honestly, that was the one part of the Patriot that I kind of liked, that rather tense sequence when he's teaching his kids to kill British officers.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what else do we got in here? Nick,
so, Dave, yeah? If I can sum up your review,
yeah,
it's like the good part of the Patriot?
Yes.
That's what you'd say? That's what they should put on the cover?
Yeah. I feel like we shouldn't have even brought it up. I feel like I think they did that on the cover. I mean, really. It's a much more thoughtful and historically driven story, and let's redact that whole last 5 minutes.
Nick, what do you got?
I do. I have a book that is not at all in any way, shape, or form historically driven.
No.
I have a book that is brutal, bloody, so full of action.
It's a trashy exploitation comic.
Well, I don't know if it's trashy. Yet. I don't know if I'd call it trashy. This is The Legacy of Luther Strode.
The third part of the trilogy.
This is the third and final part of the trilogy.
Yep.
Written by Justin Jordan and art by Trad Moore. Justin Jordan has actually outright said, yeah, this is the end of Luther's story. There's going to be, they might revisit the verse.
The Strode verse, I believe he calls it.
I think he calls it the Strode verse, yes. But this is the finale for Luther. And really, this is kind of him just...
He's at the peak of his powers.
Peak of his powers. He's just brutal.
Should we break down Luther Strode for people who haven't read it?
Yeah, I mean, Luther Strode...
I still have not read it.
...sort of began, what was it called, just The Legend of Luther Strode?
It's The Strange Talent of Luther
Strode.
And he's a kid in high school who sends away for a book, like a Charles Atlas type book.
It is like the Charles Atlas book, and it's like this weird...
It's like The Method, isn't it called?
Yeah, it's called The Method, and he basically bulks up and becomes this sort of... Looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger in a lot of ways.
And he, like, can see everybody's, like, innards and sees where everything connects, so he, like... Touch someone and make them explode, basically.
Yes.
And he can, like, flick them and knock them out.
He basically becomes, like, the peak of human, like, perfection.
And he's a super martial artist.
It's a violent Hong Kong movie with, like, heads getting punched off and stuff.
It's got elements of that.
I can't think of the name of it.
Legend of Ricky.
Legend of Ricky O?
Or Ricky O, yeah.
Yeah, I believe that's the vibe I got just at a glance.
But, I mean, there's also this side story going on in the book about his love interest.
Yeah.
Sort of... How she fits into this, and it's not the normal, because there is this love. They love each other, but she's kind of messed up,
yeah,
and sort of is going along with all of it a bit. And it's crazy as he's going up against people who are sort of part of this same world that he's in, that has sort of the same powers that he does.
Yeah,
there's
a lot, and but they tend to be sort of psycho killers.
Yeah,
basically.
I mean, the order was basically all about.
Or is it? Is there humor?
I wouldn't even call it humor. But it's definitely sort of over the top.
It seems like a lot like action manga.
You know, that is very much action manga. You know the big fight scene in Man of Steel. You know how it was like people getting knocked around, and buildings being blown up, and that kind of stuff. If that wasn't Superman, if that was just a couple of guys. Luther Strode is more like that.
That's kind of what Dragon Ball Z is.
There's a big car chase in here that just goes all over the place, and it's definitely sort of action movie taken to the highest level.
Yes. Right. And really, it's just, he's a good guy, and he's trying to do the right thing.
He's
and,
a good guy who can accidentally kill people really easily.
Yes, so he's got to work, got to get that under control, and I don't know, I've always liked it. Trad Moore's always done an amazing job with artwork.
Yeah,
He draws violence like no other artist out there.
Yeah.
It's so visceral and fun.
It does have a sense of sort of kineticism that I can't really ascribe to any other artist.
And it's also just the action scenes. I mean, Randy mentioned the car chase. The car chase is fantastic. There are scenes where people are sitting at a table while weird silhouettes of their selves sort of map out the fight that could happen
because
that's sort of their this person's ability, and it's just it's beautiful, and
it's a great I would definitely say like if you haven't read the previous ones, it might not be the best way to jump in.
No, it's not the best jumping on point,
but there are collections.
But I would definitely suggest, if you have not, pick up the first collection. It's a lot of fun.
And I think you
probably get hooked on it,
and for those who have been waiting for it, it delivers in spades. It's really good.
Randy, what is your...
So my pick is a book called Kaiju Max, which is by Xander Cannon, who you might know as one of the artists of Top Ten. He's also done a lot of webcomic stuff. But this is his new book from Oni, and it is a story about a Supermax island prison for kaiju monsters. And it's from the point of view of a sort of electric lightning bug who has been brought to the island, having left his children to go find food, and then they captured him. So he's worried about them going out and grabbing his children. He also is having to deal with all the politics of this place, which include a warden whose secret I won't give away. But
is the warden a kaiju?
No, the warden is not a kaiju. But the guy, one of the people he gets brought in with, is like the legendary devil. Oh, he's the creature from Devil's Creek.
Yeah,
and so he's like the red devil and that kind of thing. There's a guy who sort of runs the prison gangs, and they're all kaiju.
It's pretty tongue in cheek.
It's pretty tongue in cheek, but it's also just kind of cute.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think this. Did you mention the art yet? Because the art's kind of this very appealing cartoony style.
Yeah, it's got this very cartoony style. It's very beautifully colored. There's a great sequence where one of the monsters looks like he's going in and tipping over a building, and the building comes back up, and you see that it's actually their workout room as they're pushing buildings back up, down and backing up. And there's another guy in the doing like sort of footwork where he's stepping on buildings that
like
moves weights.
Like the kaiju exercise yard?
The kaiju exercise yard, yeah. And there's a lot of little fun details like that. Along with sort of a main story about this guy who's trying to look out for his kids. There's also a big surprise with the warden that cracked me up.
I love the different gangs and the prison. Yep. There's a lot of little nods, a lot of great one-liners. I was very, very impressed with it.
Yeah, if you like kaiju stuff and you like stuff with a sort of a little bit of a sense of humor, a little weird, definitely give this one a look. I was pretty happy with it. Also on my stack this week, we finally got in the Rutabaga the Adventure Chef, which is a graphic novel from Eric Colossal, who is Jess Fink's boyfriend.
Okay.
We've talked about Jess Fink before. This is his first graphic novel. It is about a medieval adventuring party, and Rutabaga is an adventure chef. So he goes through and makes exotic recipes from fantasy ingredients. It's hilarious. It's really fun. It's great for kids, but I loved it.
You're flipping through it, and so it's upside down to me, but the art looks really nice.
The art is great. It's got great cartooning. It's full color.
The color is actually really nice.
It's a little $10 trade. I loved this book, and I highly recommend it. Definitely worth a look. Also on my list this week, I won't list everything because I know Nick and Dave are going to cover a lot of it, but Big Man Plans, number 2, the image book from Eric Powell and Tim Weish, that is about a murderous revenge dwarf.
To be pretty,
it's pretty out there and fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a 70s exploitation series starring a dwarf. Jupiter's Circle, which is the prologue to Mark Millar's Jupiter's Legacy.
Oh, it's actually like a prequel?
This is sort of the Silver Age through Mark Millar's more realistic eyes.
I don't know who Wilfredo Torres is.
New artist, but his stuff is really great. Yeah, it's really good stuff. The big focus on this one is a character who is gay in the 50s, and as a superhero, he's trying to keep that closeted. There's a new issue of Saga, number 27, which is another great issue of Saga. There's a new issue of Darth Vader, number 4, which I really loved, and I'm loving his evil droids.
Yeah, the evil droids are fantastic.
There's a new issue of Spider-Man 2099, number 11, where he comes back to our modern era because, the Maestro is running his future now, so he's coming back to prevent that from happening. And then finally, Ant-Man, number 4, which is further into Ant-Man dealing with various small-time criminals. And someone who's kidnapped his daughter. And I really love that book. And the cover
is fantastic.
The cover's a Miami Vice nod.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Is it Grizzly?
It's Grizzly, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really liking this book. Nick, what else is on your list?
I have the sci-fi western 6-issue of Copperhead.
Starts a new story, right?
It does.
Yep.
And I was kind of curious as to where they were going to go with the second story. And I'm really loving it. I think the artwork is fantastic, and
yep.
Fairbear is just hitting every.
It's probably his best book.
It is. The next issue of Rat Queens, which I think sees the completion of the second story.
Long-awaited completion of the second story arc, yeah.
And this is also the second issue of Stefan Sejic's...
Should we mention his graphic novel?
Oh, yeah, Stefan Sejic.
Sunstone.
We got his erotic graphic novel Sunstone in, which is a... It's like a...
It's exactly
it's sort
what
of
it sounds like.
50 Shades of Grey-ish, I think, but better.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be... It's basically a lesbian bondage graphic novel.
Yep. Flipping through it, it's
the art is gorgeous.
Naughty,
yeah,
but it seemed I got that sort of sex positive vibe out of it. And in that sense, it seemed different from Fifty Shades with its all its controversy and over kind of like, is this kind of creepy and really controlling?
Yeah,
and
no, this is...
This looked more like a loving relationship, and his art looked really nice in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Rackman's continues to be entertaining and really layered compared to what you would expect.
Yeah.
The 45th issue?
It's issue 250.
Or possibly issue 250 of Deadpool, which...
Jerry was right.
Take it all back. Which is titled The Death of Deadpool, which actually sees the completion of his... all-out battle with Ultimatum and Flag Smasher. I'm just going to spoil it. He does die. It's right there on the cover.
Yep.
The next issue of Spider-Woman.
This was so much fun.
Which is a lot of fun. It's great. Grant Morrison's Nameless.
Third issue of Nameless,
which is... really interesting, really weird, and really dark. I mean, it's
sort of sci-fi horror, right?
Can do dark.
It's a little bit more darker than I'm used to from him. Yeah. I think it's like filth level of darkness, and I'm kind of like, wow, I haven't seen you do this in a couple years.
It reminds me of Dead Space.
Yeah, it's like Dead Space. And then I've got Howard the Duck, which I have not read yet.
Oh, the second issue of Howard the Duck is so good.
But it's... really, really fun. And then the weird 4-issue weekly series Avengers Millennium, which I'm really
enjoying. Them time traveling, right?
And then I got a trade this week, which I am super excited to read because I haven't read it in God knows how many years. But DC is finally putting out the old Deathstroke the Terminator.
From the 90s,
from
right?
From the 90s series.
That when was that first debut? Was it like early 90s?
Early 90s. Yeah. Like 91, 92.
But this is Marv Wolfman writing, and it's got Steve Irwin drawing, which... Not the Crocodile Hunter.
What I remember of Irwin was... I somewhat didn't appreciate him at the time because he is just a really strong draftsman.
Yeah.
He did good action scenes, and this book was high on action scenes. It's sort of... a cinematic way that I don't remember quite seeing a lot of other books doing. It was like cool military action sequences. Yeah.
I just remember reading it. It's sort of akin to like the Punisher War Zone, where it was just a guy being a badass, and that's exactly what Marvel
wrote. If you want
Flynn
an action comic, this one may look a little old school in its visuals, but I believe it would please.
And it is from the creator of Deathstroke. Marv Wolfman created the character.
And
so
it's got all the covers by Mike Zeck.
Which also links it to the Punisher, because Zeck did a bunch of great Punisher covers.
Yep.
Dave, what else you got?
Right, so there's a new Astro City, which is a one-shot that I really liked. It's about a guy who's... He's a mashup of a few different heroes, kind of conceptually. But I would say Adam Strange would be a primary one.
Okay,
he's like
sure.
He's an older version. He's like, imagine Adam Strange when he's like Sean Connery's age. And he has kind of a Sean Connery look about him.
So is our best.
Okay. He's he's the hero of a planet. He's got a successful novel career on Earth where he's written about his adventures.
Yeah.
He's also got a little bit of, I would say, Starman in there, like the Golden Age Starman.
Okay.
And a few other things in there, too. And then, of course, there's the spin that he is a writer. And he's kind of a little restless and not sure what direction he wants his life to take. So it has some of that Astro City thoughtfulness to it. But I really enjoyed it. Randy, did you mention Southern Cross number 2?
I did not.
So second issue of Image's Southern Cross, the sort of sci-fi mystery with a somewhat hard-to-pin-down direction, but writing by Becky Cloonan.
Yep.
It's about the girl who's going to... Is it Titan?
I believe it's Titan, yes.
To investigate her sister's death, but still continues to take place on the ship there.
Yeah.
Where there's all sorts of mysteries unfolding, and I am still not quite sure where it's going, but still enjoying it.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a new issue of S.H.I.E.L.D.
This issue of S.H.I.E.L.D. is so good.
The Invisible Woman in it, and it was a fantastic issue. It made me really sad that there's not a stronger FF book out there right now.
And the artist by Chris Sprouse.
Oh, that was who it was. Yeah. I didn't notice, actually, that it was him, but I love Chris Sprouse.
It's a great take on Invisible Woman.
The last five or six pages are pretty pulse-pounding.
Yeah.
It's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
There was also the second issue of Descender from Image.
I liked that a lot.
That's their sort of sci-fi book from Jeff Lemire, with the beautiful painted art from Dustin Nguyen.
Yeah.
that has like a sort of a boy robot, I guess in a slightly Spielbergian tradition.
Yeah.
But who has a strange link to a big galactic disastrous event and is being hunted by like these space mercenaries in this one that are kind of think Mass Effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's intercut with some flashbacks to his backstory, and it was another fun issue.
Yeah, I really liked it.
There's some cool action adventure in there and some good ideas, mm-hmm. but it also has that Spielberg-y approachableness and kind of heart. Let's see. I haven't read it yet. Randy, did you mention Storm?
I loved this issue of Storm.
I have not read it. This is issue 10? Is it standalone, or is this continuing that storyline?
It's a part one of two. And it is a it's a character I didn't know from maybe one of the recent X books, but you don't need to know the character. It's just really fun.
And I do want to mention one graphic novel in my stack, or not graphic novel. It's
a novel.
The Shakespeare Star Wars ones that have adapts Star Wars to Shakespeare. They're getting into the prequels now.
Yep.
Which we know is kind of not our favorite territory. But seems like, from what I've got flipping through this, still seems like they found fun stuff to do with it.
Talk about the Jar Jar thing. I think that's really funny.
So I don't know if this goes on throughout, but it seems like most of Jar Jar's dialogue is basically adapted from stuff he says in the movies. It's his kind of goofy pidgin English.
Yeah.
But he has asides in the Shakespearean tradition to the audience where he speaks with articulation, and it looks pretty hysterical. You know, he'll say something goofy, and Amidala will be like, "Oh, you're such a goofball, Jar Jar," and he'll do it as his aside. He's like, "The lady doth think me a beast." You know, it looks like a lot of fun. I think some of it's weirdly some of the kind of seriousness. You know, the prequels were kind of overly serious.
Yeah,
sort of works for Shakespearean drama.
Yeah,
even we were talking about like the Queen's disguise stuff, which was kind of like bad premise for the movie, her stand-ins.
Yeah.
Seems very Shakespearean. That kind of disguise work. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that.
And Dave, what's the title of this one?
This one is it The Phantom of Menace?
Yes. Forsooth, The Phantom of Menace,
I believe. Does it say that on
does
the...
Does it not? That's
how it is in the thing, but yeah, it doesn't say it on the front.
Yeah.
There's also a few other sort of notable books this week that I haven't gotten around to reading.
Right.
Todd McFarlane's new book with Brian, how do you say it? Holguin?
Yeah,
Holguin?
Yeah.
And then Clayton Crane,
who, if you follow like the various Carnage miniseries and stuff lately, he's that guy who does that kind of painty, heavy metalish kind of art.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, is it a horror book? I don't know what it is.
Ongoing. Basically, it's a guy with godlike powers and what would happen in a real world situation with that.
Yes.
Okay. So it seems like fans of like Spawn and what's the other book he did with them?
Haunt.
Yeah, should probably check this out.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the DC's Convergence hits in a big way this week.
Yeah, there's the main series, it's number one, and then I think there's 12 new books of the two-issue miniseries.
Yeah, somewhere around there. I think where the issue zero was sort of meandering, this one has like sort of more heroes in it and definitely gets to the heart of the storyline going on. And then, you know, after that there's like the Question One by Greg Rucka.
Yep.
Is it Dan Jurgens on Superman?
Dan Jurgens on Superman with Lee Weeks on art, yeah.
Yep. So they've got some pretty notable creative teams in here, and we shall see.
All right. That'll close up our comics talk for this week. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about some movies, some podcasts, and some games. All right, so we're going to talk about some movies and some other stuff going on. But before we do that, there's one last bit of comic thing from Dave.
Right, I have a cheater pick for last week.
Yep.
It was last week, right?
It was last week.
So all of the Batman books at DC have been doing these endgame one-shots where you kind of see, because basically the Joker is like Jokerized the whole city or big chunks of it.
Yeah.
And so I assume chaos is breaking out everywhere. I haven't been following it closely, but I did decide to randomly read the one-shot for Gotham Academy, their Harry Potter-esque take on a Gotham boarding school. And I really like the issue. It's got the regular writer, but several different artists. And the basic premise is that while this chaos is happening at the city and there's a storm going on and everything, the kids are all kind of holed up at the academy. It's like as if there's like a citywide curfew or maybe even like martial law in effect. But what that practically translates into is more like kids kind of holed up in a storm telling stories.
Sure.
And they're all Joker related. They're kind of trying, in a way, trying to scare each other. And I think they are even like in a little tent that they've built. And it's got the regular characters, plus I think one or two characters I don't know yet because I haven't followed the series that closely.
Right.
But it's a good standalone issue because each of the three stories you get that are sort of deal with the Joker's origin or people who could, like, one of them is even like a story from Scotland about the Laughing Man, you know, this weird minstrel who travels around and has like this weird curse on him. They're all creepy stories. I liked all three of them. And the various artists they brought in for them, which I don't know if I know who all these guys are. I can't find the credits page. Anyway, they kind of work in a creepy animated series style, I guess I'd say.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of recommend the issue in a way for if you're already following Gotham Academy, you're already going to have this. But if you're kind of curious about it or just want a good Joker story, honestly, this is a good random issue to pick up.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was surprisingly fun. Maybe might have even made my pick of the week last week had I read it at the time of our podcast.
All right. We've talked about this before. We played Battlestar Galactica, board game. Dave and I know have mentioned it, but Nick had never played it before.
That's true.
So, Nick, what were your thoughts about Battlestar Galactica?
Cylons are evil.
Yeah.
And they kill lots and lots of humans.
Yep.
Right. So the humans lost as they always seem to lose when we play.
Well, and there were four of us, the three of us and our friend Nathan.
Yep. Yeah.
And we were playing, and Nathan hadn't played before either.
Friends of Nathan should know Nathan is a Cylon.
Yes, Nathan's a Cylon.
You should go ahead and get that out there right now. He turned out to be the Cylon.
So we were doing really well, like better than I've done in any of the previous games I've played.
Right. We had a sequence where there was nothing going on
It was clear.
And so we just were like, let's gather resources.
It was kind of odd because the way you guys have talked about it is sort of just this harrowing experience right from the get-go.
Yeah.
I'm like, for the first like maybe four or five turns, somewhere in that ballpark. We were kind of just sailing along. Yeah,
although we did still start out in, you know, there were still Cylons in our initial territory.
But we cleared them out fast.
We cleared them out pretty quickly.
Yeah, Nick, you were playing as Starbuck, and you got to do some way cool stuff, honestly, with your card. You were, like, chewing up Cylons.
Yep.
And later on in the game had a sequence where I think you were able to take two turns.
You became the Admiral, and you nuked a base star, and then went and shot up all the raiders that were left.
That's true.
And then, like, I don't know if it was the same turn, but then basically, like, emergency landed on the Galactica and killed the Cylon incursion.
Yeah, that's right. There was a Cylon on board.
That was after I just crashed my
into it. That was actually after the Cylon got revealed.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny is, Dave, you were playing the President, and you were over on Colonial One, and you came over to us to jump the ship.
Yep.
Because someone had to jump the ship, and you jumped a little early because we were getting surrounded.
Yeah.
And then, because the Cylon got revealed, and then right after you came over to the ship,
he blew up
Colonial One with a nuke.
Yeah. And I had not seen that card used before, but we couldn't go back to it for the rest of the game. He blew up the whole ship.
It was kind of great because it was like we had just nuked his base star, and he's like, oh, you nuked my base star? I nuke your Colonial One.
Yeah. It's Sean Connery in The Untouchables. Yeah.
But what's funny is that we were doing pretty well, and then just things got bad. Morale went down. We were down on every resource.
Yeah.
And he was over there throwing things at us, and we just kept finding
bad. And
somebody,
it's like all the Cylon incursions that we had lucked out of avoiding into avoiding early on, they all showed up at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like he gave them the signal.
We started compounding upon one another, and we couldn't make jumps, and it was just...
Yeah, it was brutal.
It was brutal, and we lost hard.
Yeah.
It's like Pandemic.
Yeah.
It's a game that I've enjoyed every time I've lost.
No, the desperation one was really interesting, because we were like, well, okay. And the one we lost is we made a jump and lost our population.
Yep.
Like, we were surrounded by Cylons. And we knew it was too early to jump, and the jump could have cost us all the remaining population we had, and that would lose us the game. But it was like, well, we either jump and potentially lose the population, or we stay here and we all know that we get killed.
Yeah.
So it was very much a last-ditch kind of effort.
Yeah, we jumped in something about the place where we warped into made us lose some population.
Yeah, it just got bad. We just lost everybody.
It's Fantasy Player, right?
Yeah.
They've done a really great job of capturing sort of the craziness and sort of the harrowing experience of the first season of Battlestar Galactica in a board game format.
Yeah.
I just think it's across the board, great components.
Yeah.
Really fun mechanics.
Yeah.
And
you can probably just in glimpsing it, Nick, see how it's, depending on what character you get, it's very different. So you were mostly out there like chewing up Cylons with a Viper, but also periodically contributing cards that helped other people do stuff, and
I can see it. We played with a four-player game, and I can see it being even more entertaining. With it can go up to what, six?
Six,
I think so.
Yeah.
I was playing the president, which meant I was mostly drawing like quorum cards and was like one of the few ways you can help out, help regain resources and stuff like that.
Yep.
I didn't get anything great with it. And Randy, you were playing as
I was playing a chief.
Yep. So you were doing all the repairs for us.
Yes.
And Nathan, prior to his traitorism, was Saul Tai.
Saul Tai, who was the admiral.
Yep. He was the admiral. Just I know he was itching to declare martial law, but he never got around to it before he became
a Cylon. He actually outright said he didn't want to be the Cylon, but he was.
But then he had fun when it happened.
He had fun when it happened, and then afterwards, Nick was on his phone, and he's like, you know, there's a Fast and Furious screening in like 20 minutes.
And it was an added screening, if I'm not mistaken. We thought that we were going to miss out on seeing this like opening night.
And I actually did not see the showing when I looked before.
And you two and Nathan jumped in his car and drove to the screening.
He drove like a maniac.
He really did.
That's something else Nathan's friend should know.
He was trying to get you into the Fast and Furious mood.
He did. He succeeded.
Actually, it was fun because it's been a while since I've like done a cutting it that close to the movie. I mean, we got there probably with like 3 minutes before it started.
Usually you don't do that at the draft house. You kind of have to plan.
Yeah.
But we knew there'd be trailers and stuff as a buffer if we missed it. And it was a stupid and ridiculous good time.
Yeah. I mean, this is exactly what I wanted
people
out of it.
People kind
of
know what they're getting into at this point.
I mean, I do feel The Rock sweats on command.
His first scene, he's sweating. He's wiping his giant sweat beads.
Jason Statham gets to be a badass.
Yep. You know you're a badass when you beat up The Rock.
That's true. Early on in the movie. Like, first scene.
My general sense of the movies, I have not seen anything prior to 5. I came in on 5, which was kind of, in some ways, I think the big team-up one.
Yeah, it was.
The biggest one of them all, as far as that goes. And that was my favorite, and I don't know if it's just sort of...
The heist one.
It was the heist one. Is that the one where they had the safe?
Yep.
So they were driving around dragging a safe behind them and hitting stuff with it.
Yeah. It was pretty great.
And I was like, this is like a crazy superhero kind of thing, because honestly, they're kind of like Mission Bro Possible.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, that's very true.
They're sort of like rogues with a heart of gold. Yeah. They're always standing by their buddies and stuff like that. And occasionally they'll run into like some lawman like The Rock who will end up joining forces with them.
But the consequences aren't
usually super high. There's not a lot of death in them. And there's even like was a retcon in number 5 like that made it retroactively take place prior to number 2, right?
3.
Or 3, yeah. But anyway, so that one was my favorite. And I've liked each successive one a little bit less, to be honest. But they're still fun. Like I didn't like 6 as much as 5 and I didn't like 7 as much as 6. But at the same time...
But you're still going to see 8.
Yeah. They still parachuted planes out of a C-130. They parachuted cars out of a C-130 so they could basically land on a sheer mountainside in motion.
Yeah.
For a big roadside heist against like these armed, you know, what is it, Eastern European? Or
yeah,
what?
Something
I forget what their deal was, but that was my favorite sequence in it.
Yeah. And plus you got, you know, we get badass Kurt Russell.
That's what you were saying, Nick. He's the Rock of this one, the authority figure who needs to hire their CIA cover agent.
I think he's called Mr. Nobody, if I remember correctly.
The game designer, John Wick, I follow him a little bit on Facebook, and he saw it and really enjoyed it. And this was his first Fast and Furious movie. Mm-hmm. And he described it as being like an alternate universe where like, where white people don't run everything because they are very racially diverse.
Yeah, they are.
Where he's like he described the people as being like street shamans who channel their energy through their cars. He was basically putting it in gamer terms, but he wasn't wrong. It is kind of it has this weird alternate reality that feels a lot like sort of a gamer.
I think my favorite sequence was where Vin Diesel drives a car and was it Abu Dhabi? Through the towers of
it's
two or three successive towers.
Right. It deliberately crashes from one tower to the next, but then like their brakes are damaged, and so they have to go through the next tower. It is a ridiculous and awesome scene.
You know, it's funny. I've not been big into. I've only seen the first one, maybe two, and I just couldn't quite get into. Mm-hmm. But you guys are selling me. I'm going to have to go back and watch this.
For me, it's this weird thing because I watched the first one in theaters when it released.
Yeah.
And it's this... I was in high school at the time, so this
You've
weird,
grown up with them.
I've grown up with them, and there's this weird continuity throughout seven films that I'm like...
They definitely have continuity.
Like, I'm like...
The same way the old Planet of the Apes, the original Planet of the Apes, where there was like seven movies, but they were all actually really pretty tightly...
It's funny, this is maybe the... this is the first cinematic universe, was the Fast and Furious first.
They've made it that.
Yeah.
Now, Randy, you started with the beginning?
I saw the first one. I liked it well enough.
Did you ever see like the fifth one?
I haven't seen the fifth one.
Yeah, I would jump to it.
Yeah, maybe I should.
Just cut to the chase on that one.
Yeah, the other ones are
most fun.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
But I mean, this one, they actually brought in the, you know, Tokyo Drift and the, you know,
right?
Had the, that main star.
Right. There was stuff I didn't know. There were things in this that happened that are continuity, Easter eggs for fans that I was just like, I don't know who this guy is, but it's clear from the audience's reaction that he was somebody in a previous movie and they're like, yay, look, it's.
This is also kind of, I think, what I wanted from the Expendables.
Oh,
big,
yeah,
stupid fun.
So.
Is that? I think Nathan made that
while
he was driving like a maniac to get there. that it was what he wanted in Expendables.
Well, and I was actually
more fun, less kind of.
Well,
I don't know.
Justin Lin has been sort of the head of these movies. I mean, he's directed the last, I think, four of them. Maybe I could be wrong about that. And he didn't do this one, and I was kind of not worried because I figured it'd still be stupid fun action.
Yeah.
But James Wan actually directed this, the guy who did...
kind of known for his horror stuff, like Insidious.
Insidious.
And The Conjuring.
Yeah. And he sort of gets in the driver's seat and sort of just kind of makes it like it should have been.
Yeah, it had the action sequences all had that kind of crazy high-octane thing. It's not enough for a car to speed by the camera. The camera has to be like flying at the car as the car speeds by. So it's all hyperkinetic that way.
Right.
But the action scenes are very clear too, I felt.
And like, I actually felt there is sort of a somber...
Although it did get too ridiculous at the end, even for Fast and Furious.
And there is a little bit
of
a
aliens?
Somber note. There's not aliens.
It was even more superhero-y than I thought.
Yeah.
I don't want to give away quite what's going on,
but
there's like air-to-ground action, helicopters versus cars versus people with chain guns. It was a video. It was a video game by the end.
Yeah.
It was definitely a video game.
And there is a somber note because this Paul Walker did die
in the production of.
And
you know, I thought they were going to kind of maybe have his character die in the movie or halfway through it, kind of do a thing where he's like, protect him, he was going to have to go into hiding. But he and his wife would go off and have a quasi-happy ending but get shuffled off.
Yeah.
They keep him around through the whole movie.
Yeah. And I think they do that.
He's there for the ending sequence, the touching ending sequence.
And the ones, I think the scenes that they didn't have in their film, I think is he's got twin brothers.
That's what somebody told me. There were some times when I'm like, he looks kind of different here.
Yeah, I mean, they did what they could.
Yeah.
And I actually think they got away with it for the most part.
There was kind of quicker cuts, and I think sometimes they'd be like, okay, we're looking at the back of him now while he's talking, and it seemed a little like a slightly weird cut, but I see what they're doing.
But he does get a good ending. And
it's relatively seamless as far as... I think they did the best they could with it.
Spoilers.
Spoilers, yeah.
So, last week was movie week for us, because Nick, you also saw a movie, and Dave and I saw a movie. We saw It Follows.
Oh, yes. Right, which you had seen previously.
I did. I saw a couple, the week before you guys did, I think.
Yeah, you did.
And did we talk about the premise?
We talked about the trailer.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of an indie horror movie, which I think, I didn't know this before, but I think we can say it's explicitly a sexually transmitted curse.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
It's, and it seems to take place, at least visually, in an 80s type era.
It's very 80s period piece, except that somebody has a cell phone and there's some other stuff that's referenced.
Right. There's a little bit weird, but I kind of assumed that that was meant, at least initially, to kind of mirror like the rise of AIDS.
As
a kind of a,
one of the big terrors of the 80s. You can take from it, but I think, I mean, they outright say it takes place in Detroit, and it's, I mean, I've been to Detroit's airport. I can't say what the outlining suburban areas look like, but
it looked ugly enough to be what I perceived.
Yeah,
to be
what
Detroit
I perceived to be Detroit.
There was sort of a indie squalor chic going on.
Yeah, that's sort of kind of mired in the past a little bit because it hasn't gone forward.
Also looked kind of weirdly like what I think of as like, yeah, my friends kind of looked like that in the 80s when we were just hanging around. Which is kind of dumpy.
Yeah.
People in, like, bad t-shirts and, you know, bad hair and stuff.
Yeah,
Now, Randy, this is a mildly polarizing. You kind of were dissatisfied with it?
I was mostly unhappy with it. I liked the premise a lot, And I thought the characters were a little weak, and I thought the story just kind of meandered sort of and never really came. Yeah, it never came to any kind of conclusion to me. I'm like, okay, so it just kind of ended.
You know what it struck me, Randy? You know, and weirdly, this is something I know we all like. You know how in Lost,
yeah,
there was, like, they never showed scenes of the characters asking kind of the questions that would be the logical questions.
Yeah.
Like, there was no group meeting to say, now, do we think that this is something mystical out there, that smoke monster, or yeah, why are we here?
Yeah.
Instead, the questions were kind of dramatic ones like, are you with Sawyer's group or Jack's? You yeah know, they kind of yeah created their own internal drama.
Yeah, no, that's about right.
This was a little bit more like that. There was, I think, those scenes that we expected where they were where you might, like, think, well, can we figure this curse out?
Yeah.
Can we find out more about it?
Yeah.
It was less about that than it was about certain ideas.
Yeah.
I think it didn't want to be too much sort of mainstream horror. I mean, it was definitely...
No, yeah. It did sort of have some deliberately indie affectations.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I thought there were bits of... There was really scary stuff in here.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to quite say,
no,
what,
I want to say what it is,
but... But its particular method of pursuing its victim or whatever, mm-hmm, is pretty creepy.
It is.
Like, I would have been... I like horror movies sometimes, even if I don't wholly like them, for if they offer me something different. And this is definitely the sort of the threat in this is very memorable in its execution.
Yeah.
Nick, I think you probably liked it the most of the three of us. I was somewhere in between.
I really enjoyed it. And the more I sort of...
Do you think you'll buy it?
Yeah, probably so. The more I pondered about it, and I actually will just be very interested to hear sort of some, or see some of the special features on it. Maybe listen
to
the director's commentary.
Yeah.
But I think I was overall really, really happy with it. Sort of the execution and I didn't need to know everything, so I was very happy with what I got, and I loved the music. I thought the music, the cues
it was
that
like
it gave,
this
and sort of this
ominous
weird
synth score.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the movie Drive?
Yeah.
That sort of had that
yeah
synth
it had
yeah score.
Kind of ambient.
Yeah, yeah, and it had very much in that sort of vein, but it kind of drove the story and each scene in such a way where, I mean, he would even kind of trick you in some ways.
Right, there was sometimes this dramatic, ominous music in a scene that ultimately proves not to
there's
be
nothing going on,
a
yeah
threat.
No, yeah, but, I mean, to the characters, they, I mean, you know.
Well, I noticed that they really didn't do a lot of, in the way of jump scares, which I appreciated. Didn't
yeah
kind of do
there were a couple.
Few,
there's
but
a few,
for the most
but
part
most of them were kind of, they tended to be sort of, I guess they were sort of the cheap jump scares.
There's at least one cheap jump scare.
But there wasn't a whole lot of, like, looking for the bad guy, turn around, bad guy is there.
Yeah.
They didn't really do that kind of stuff,
it's
and
just
I appreciate
this air
that
of ominous.
So yeah, the music in a way took the place of some of the what would we would think of as those kind of timing scares.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really liked it. I would suggest
and
going to see it.
And I would recommend it, if nothing else, as a rental to horror fans. It does offer up something different. I kind of agree with Randy that there's some dissatisfying elements for me, but I think it's still worth a look for horror
fans. I'm also not a huge horror fan, and I think
yeah
that was the thing. Is like, if you're at all a horror fan, I think you'll like this more than I
yeah
do.
I'm not going to go into specifics, but I've actually followed a few little threads online sort of discussing the film and sort of what ifs and, you know, why was this mentioned. And there's some really interesting discussions going on about some possible ideas.
Yeah,
so I'm
interesting.
I would really, really say go see it.
All right, and just real quick, Dave, I know you've been playing a video game you wanted to mention.
Oh, yeah, on the kind of weird game level. I didn't know anything about this game, which is a downloadable game for PS3 and probably some other stuff. The game is called Life is Strange.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a quirky high school drama of sorts, but very much in the style of, probably in response to Telltale games.
Yeah.
So sort of heavily dialogue-driven with a little bit of a strange mechanic. The idea is that it takes place at this school specifically, or like kind of like a private school for photographers, like for people who are like going to be like photography majors and stuff. Like
yeah
everybody at the school, in this very small school, is in some way, shape, or form working on photography.
Okay.
And your lead character is kind of a bit of a wallflower type of character who's... when it begins, she has this mysterious dream that's like there's this storm taking place at like on the coast of the town, and there's like this giant like what looks like a tornado that's miles wide. It looked really cool. Kind of has a stylish cell shaded look to it, mm-hmm, to the game. And she wakes up in class, I think, with sort of a start in the beginning. And then an event follows where she ends up going to the restroom and somebody is killed there.
At which point she kind of discovers she has this ability to spool back time.
Okay.
Just not like hours and hours, but maybe the last several minutes and change things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you actually sort of relive the opening classroom sequence now with knowledge of like what some of the answers to questions are. And as she discovers it, you discover it. And a mystery is set up involving sort of whether this event is going to happen. She actually sees like a newspaper in this dream of this storm that's like about a week out. Mm-hmm. So presumably the game, it does seize, you know, like episodes just like the Walking Dead game from Telltale Games.
Yeah, yeah.
That is sort of the timeline. Like at the end of the week, something horrible is going to happen. There's also a missing girl. There's this kind of David Lynchian vibe to it. Along with some of, like, I would almost say, like, a Mean Girls or something vibe.
Right, right.
It's got all the clicks in there. It sort of walks a line between a little bit hipster and a little bit cliche. But I overall felt that the writing on it was, like, the dialogue was much stronger than I expected it to be. And,
how's the voice acting?
Good, very good. There's a little weirdness in the sense that I don't know if it's a Japanese game first, but there's not particularly strong lip syncing. It's like their mouths are moving, and the dialogue is good, but it's not synced up.
Okay, all right.
It didn't really bother me, but yeah, I guess it might bother some people. I've played the first two episodes, which are all that are out right now, and although I've got some critiques of it, there's a free demo, and I'd say if the idea intrigues a person, they should try it, or if they've... it's a little linear, for instance,
yeah.
I feel, but it does track all of your choices. Like, when you finish an episode, you can it'll be like, here's the 20 key points in it where you made various decisions, which are going to affect the future. And they also show, like, I think if you have friends who played it, what decisions they made.
That's actually one of my favorite things about the Telltale.
Is that
when
it shows you
at the end of the Telltale games, at the end of each chapter, it says... This percentage of people did this. Percentage of people did this.
They totally ripped that off.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly what they do.
I still need to play one of the Telltale games.
I played Fables Wolf Among Us and loved it.
So I played some of the Walking Dead one.
Yeah.
And weirdly, although I thought it was like really well done, I didn't finish it because I think it was almost like weirdly too intense.
Yeah.
Like it was too emotionally wrought.
I just lost time. I loved the game. I still have it, but it's on my Xbox, which is in the other room, so I don't play it as often. One of these days I'm going to sit down and finish it, and then I'll get some of the other ones. But yeah, I really like Telltale.
I may see if I can get around to playing it after I do this one, because it's weird.
Maybe we should play it at the same time, we can talk about it.
We should. Like, I suspect it's probably overall a better game than Life is Strange, and yet I found myself playing that one where I hadn't Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And I think part of it was I did kind of enjoy its original universe. I didn't know whether there was going to be, like, a lot of supernatural stuff, or what seems to be more the case, low level, like, you're the only person who's exhibiting any strange powers, but there is a weird mystery going on.
Yeah.
Lots of suspects and questions about... The characters kind of become deeper as time goes by, so people who seem like, oh... This guy is just the cliché bully. Okay, there's more going on to his story. There's more going on to the school security guard and everybody else you meet. So, anyway, well, at least worth a look, I would say.
All right. I was going to mention a couple of podcasts I started listening to. One is from NPR, and it's with Anna Sale, and it's called Death, Sex, and Money. Basically, it's about the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. And it is... I've listened to several of these episodes.
By the way, Randy, real quick, does NPR also produce This American Life?
They used to. That's a separate thing.
Okay, just curious.
Yeah. So this is a really good show. It's out of WNYC, which is, I believe, where American Life... This American Life is Chicago.
Yes.
This is WNYC, which also does some other public radio stuff. But basically, the first episode I listened to had Ken Jeong, the comedian, talking about... I guess he's a doctor. He was actually a doctor before he was a comedian.
Huh.
And his... Right as he got his big break to do The Hangover, his wife was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Jeez. Oh,
and they sort of talk about that, and you know she's fine now, but they talk about you know him dealing with that and dealing with wanting to be an actor and all. It's a really great interview and a great piece.
It sounds like kind of intimate stories.
No, it's not really. It's more interviews. I mean, it's not, but it's just the topics are either about death, sex, or money. They have one that's about cheating. It's a whole episode about cheating and people who have been cheated on or people who have cheated on people and sort of the you know what that's like.
Right.
And I've listened to a handful of these and they're all really really good.
Sounds really good. I'm thinking about going out to grab a walk later tonight and maybe I will try this.
Definitely worth a listen. There's actually one that the reason I listened to it was crossover with Dan Savage.
Okay.
And Dan Savage has one where he's interviewed by her.
Oh, yeah.
And I would recommend that as the first one to start with.
I will do it. I like Dan Savage.
There's also one that was recommended to me. It's called The Truth. And it is it's a storytelling podcast, a little audio drama kind of thing. And there's a bunch of different ones. The one that was recommended to me that I listened to was called Chaotic Neutral. Mm-hmm. And it's a little story about a gaming group waiting on one of the gamers to show up. And it takes a bit of a twist, and...
So this is... It is a work of fiction?
It's a work of fiction.
And is it like an audio play, or...
It's an audio play.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's short. They're like 10 minutes long.
You know, I was just listening to This American Life the other week that adapted a short story from a book into a short audio play.
Yeah.
And I love when they do that kind of stuff. And it was really cool.
Yeah.
It was just like a little 3-4 minute thing.
Well, this one in particular, this is...
How long are these?
These ones, well, I thought it was like 10 minutes. I looked at the newest episode, and it's 28. So somewhere between 15 and 30 minutes.
Okay.
But this episode in particular, Chaotic Neutral, it's a gaming group. So I feel like it would reach out to a lot of our people. But it takes an interesting turn and becomes sort of a human drama. And I really liked it.
Not just a bunch of a spoof about eating Cheetos.
Yeah, no, stuff. It's not a gaming spoof. It is just it's a drama that takes place against the backdrop of a game night.
That sounds really cool.
Definitely recommended, and that is the episode I would recommend starting with. So
The Truth.
Okay. And I'll put a link to all this stuff in our website.
But is there a commonality among their audio dramas?
Not that I know of. I've only listened to one so far.
Okay.
So I believe they're all sort of standalone stories.
Cool.
Yeah. So that about wraps it up for us this week, and we'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.